This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 42 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we are joined by Ariel Helwani, who is undeniably one of the foremost voices on MMA. Ariel, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I'm really appreciative that we were able to make this work. And while I have you here, I want to just ask about the New York Knicks and 14 games left in the regular season. Where's your confidence level on the Knicks right now?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm a huge fan of the site and everything you guys do, and I've been reading awesome. The site long before I was even in the business. If you want to put it that way, a bit of a weird thing to say in the business, feels a little pretentious, but you get my point. Yeah. I love it. And I'm a big admirer, and I do have to apologize to you, even though the audience won't know what I'm talking about. I'm so apologetic about the fact that I'm crazy when it comes to booking my show and timing and making sure people are on time. And I've jerked you around. And it wasn't necessarily my fault, but I will take full.
No, it was 100% not your fault.
I'm going to take full blame for this. So I apologize profusely. And I hope you guys don't write very mean things about me on the website. No, all that out of the way.
Won't hold it against you.
I'm a diehard Knicks fan. I've been a Knicks fan since 1990. Yes, I'm from Montreal. Yes, there's a team called the Toronto Raptors. They only came in 1995, and I was never a Raptors fan. Patrick Ewing's my favorite athlete of all time. I've lived and died with this team way too many times, and I don't really know how to feel right now because we're talking on a Tuesday. This is coming off an incredible win over the Warriors on Monday night in the Bay. Prior to that, an amazing gut check type of win against the Kings. Prior to that, a nice win on the road against the Trailblazers. We're talking about a team that is decimated with injuries, and every time Jalen Brunson gets banged up, I'm holding my breath, and it's happened twice already in the last 2 months, once with his ankle, once with his knee. But I feel like this is one of the most fun Knicks teams of the last 25 years, and he is our guy, and I adore him, and I remember his dad being on the 99 Knicks, and I just want OG to be okay,
yeah,
and Julius to be okay, and Mitch to come back, and I really believe that if we have those three guys, in addition to the other guys, Deuce McBride, holy smokes, what a revelation. If those guys could come back healthy, I really believe we could beat anyone, not just in the East, but in the NBA. I believe it in my heart and soul, and it's just a very exciting time. There's nothing more exciting than the Knicks playing well in the spring. It unifies the whole city. The Nets don't exist. Everyone, there's Yankees fans, there's Mets fans, there's Jets fans, there's Giants fans, there's Rangers, there's Islanders. The Knicks are the one unifying team, and I just want a long run into June. It would be fantastic. And also, if I could just add, this is the first year that I feel like my boys who are age 12 and 10 are really getting into it. Like they can name all the players. So it reminds me of, you know, when I was a 10 and 12 year old kid, and it's just so much fun to talk to them about Dante DiVincenzo and Alec Burks and boy, like even those guys. So a great time.
I'm concerned about Julius Randle. I'm very concerned about OG Anunoby. The fact that he needed an MRI yesterday,
it's awful.
Yeah. Great that it came back negative, but just the fact that they sent him to New York for an MRI is definitely concerning. So
every time he was shooting in those two games, he's yelling and he's wincing and he's holding.
Yeah, no, it was clear that he was uncomfortable.
Very, very.
Why, just before we kind of move on, why the Knicks and not the more obvious choice of Michael Jordan and the Bulls? Since you had the option to choose any team,
yes,
how'd you end up with the Knicks?
So fantastic question. My two older brothers, Mark and David, were huge Bulls fans in the 90s, as was every kid who grew up in the 90s. Bulls and Cowboys, like the worst bandwagoners of all time. I was Knicks and Bills. So you can see I choose pain. And in 1990, I'm 8 years old and we're in a shoe store. And I don't know if they were playing a prank on me. I don't know if they were trying to make me look dumb. I don't know what their motives were at the time, but they said, you should get those shoes over there. And they were Patrick Ewing shoes. And I don't know if you remember Ewing shoes, but they were very big, bulky, sometimes not the most aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah.
And I listened to them because they're my older brothers. And then I was like, all right, well, who's this Ewing guy? And I remember watching him, and this was, you know, the 90-91 team. And that was the team that made it to the playoffs and lost to the Bulls, but there was some grit there. And then 92 with X-Men, and they go seven games against the Bulls in the second round. And I'm crying after that. And then I was like in love. Like once that 92 team went seven games with the Bulls and X went in Jordan's face, I was like, this is my team. And then of course, 93 was a heartbreaker, 94, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I just, much like with the Bills, my favorite baseball team was the Montreal Expos. I just love the underdog. I'm an underdog kind of guy. I kind of view myself as a bit of an underdog, even in my current profession. And I just felt like a kinship to those guys.
Yeah, no, it was an easy team to fall in love with and an easy team to root for, even though it came with an awful lot of heartbreak and continues to do so. But we'll go from a sport that I know a good bit about to a sport that I don't know that much about. And that is the MMA and the UFC and MMA. How far back does your MMA fandom go?
Oh man. I remember watching UFC 1 at my grandparents' house. So they had one of those like pay-per-view boxes where, you know, you didn't necessarily have to pay for all of them back in the day, you know, and things, there were only like four channels, unlike today where you get a gazillion channels. There were only like four, and like things would just play on loop. So they would get the wrestling pay-per-views, they would get the boxing, they would get UFC, and then, you know, the movies and whatnot. And I didn't watch UFC 1 live. That was on November 12th, 1993, but I definitely saw it a few weeks later and I was intrigued by it because I was a gigantic sports fan as a kid, like obsessed. I could tell you the 12th man on the, you know, 93 Clippers. I was like that kind of kid. And in addition to traditional sports fan, I was also a massive combat sports fan. Like the first thing I really loved was pro wrestling as a youngster. The first athlete that I truly admired and looked up to was Bret the Hitman Hart. I adored him. And so from pro wrestling, I started to get into boxing. And, you know, now we're talking about the late 80s with Mike Tyson and whatnot. And then from that, I was like, wait a second, like, what is this? Is this pro wrestling? Is this boxing? Like this thing called the UFC? It felt like this blend of both crazy worlds. And I was captivated by it. But it was very hard back then to actually follow it. There were only like three, four events a year. MMA wasn't even a term. The term MMA came several years later. Some people would call it ultimate fighting. Some people called it NHB, which is no holds barred fighting. It wasn't a thing, and it was very hard to keep up with it because the internet wasn't really a thing just yet. But it kept becoming a thing more and more. And, you know, I was aware of it. I would follow it. I would rent the videos, et cetera, et cetera. And that brings me to when I'm deciding to go where I'm going to go to school. In the ninth grade, I'm reading Sports Illustrated. I shouldn't have been reading Sports Illustrated. I should have been reading the book that we were supposed to be reading in ninth grade English class. And it was a Sports Illustrated issue which broke down the best schools in America for X, Y, and Z. And there was a little blurb that stated that Syracuse University is the best school for sports broadcasting. And they named famous people that went there, such as Bob Costas and Marv Albert. Now, I adore the NBA, and at the time, I adored the NBA on NBC, and I was like, Bob Costas and Marv Albert, those are the guys on the NBA on NBC. I need to go to this school. So that was my dream. I'm going to go to Syracuse. And when I get to Syracuse in 2001, for the first time in my life, every single kid surrounding me at Newhouse or even like around where I was, you know, hanging out, all wanted to be the next Bob Costas and Marv Albert. And so being the underdog, being the one who doesn't like to follow the pack, I remember telling my parents in 2001, there's this thing called the UFC. There's this sport called MMA. By then it had become a term. No one's covering it. No one is actually the guy. No one is the face, the voice, etc. I want to be the Howard Cosell of MMA. I loved Howard Cosell. I loved his impact on boxing, etc. Let me try to be that guy. And that's kind of where my journey, as far as being like an MMA journalist, reporter, personality, whatever you want to call me, that's where it began.
Who were some of the people that you went to Syracuse with that are now successful in sports media?
So there's one guy in particular, and it's a funny story because my time at Syracuse was actually miserable. It was probably the three hardest years of my life. I was extremely homesick and very depressed. I actually didn't get into Newhouse originally. I applied to Newhouse, and then I got a letter back which stated, congratulations, you've just been accepted into the school of visual and performing arts and speech communication. And I came to find out that that's kind of where they put the rejects who didn't have good enough grades. And then they said, if you get a 3.5 or higher GPA, you can transfer to Newhouse. So I got a 3.51, just barely, hardly interacted with anyone, and got into Newhouse, and then all was well. There's a broadcaster, and this speaks to just like how much I kept to myself and how kind of, I don't know, lonely, quiet I was. Anish Shroff, who does ESPN work, I believe lacrosse, and I think he does stuff for the Carolina Panthers, if I believe.
Yeah, he's their radio voice.
Yeah, he was in a bunch of my classes, and one time, not that long ago, maybe a couple of years ago, someone on Twitter tagged both of us and said, hey, I think you guys went to Syracuse at around the same time, Newhouse at around the same time. Did you know each other? And he wrote back, no, you know, I've never met Ariel. And that just goes to show how irrelevant I was, because I've definitely met him and sat next to him. And no hard feelings whatsoever. I was a very sort of forgettable person, because I just kept to myself. And I had a radio show every Saturday morning where I talked about combat sports. No one listened to this. No one cared about it. But this was all me kind of working towards where I wanted to be. And sure. So, yeah, so that's one name that comes to mind. I think there are others, but no one really of note.
Did you ever just view MMA as like a stepping stone for your career, or did you always have, did you always kind of recognize the untapped potential in the sport? Like when you were in college, did you ever think about where the sport might be in 20 years and what your impact on the sport could be?
Yeah, honestly, I really felt like they were just scratching the surface. It was a Friday night, and I was watching the Best Damn Sports Show, period. Do you remember that show?
Yep.
And Tito Ortiz and Ken Shamrock were on. And I was like, holy smokes, this is like 2002, 2003. And mainstream media, like now, you know, you see it on ESPN, you see it all over the place. No big deal. But back then, cable TV wasn't talking about the UFC. And I was like, holy smokes, this is incredible. Tito Ortiz, Ken Shamrock on the Best Damn Sports Show. This is as mainstream as it gets. And so I felt like there was just so much more to do. But I poured everything into that dream. I'd be lying if I didn't say, like, and I still feel this way. Like, I don't want to just be known as the MMA guy. I never wanted to just be known as the MMA guy, but I felt there was this massive opening. And I felt even as a fan that the sport wasn't being covered the way I thought it should be covered and wanted it to be covered. So when I finally like broke in, I was like, all right, I'm going to show up. You know, everyone was doing interviews with like camcorders and just asking questions. I'm like, I'm going to get a cameraman. I'm going to wear a suit. I'm going to have a microphone with a mic flag. Like, I just wanted to make it a little bit more professional. And I think that's what drew, you know, some of the audience to me early on.
So 20 years ago, the sport is just scratching the surface. What about 20 years from now? Like, what do you still view the growth potential of the UFC and MMA in general as?
I still think it could get a lot bigger. Obviously, you know, it's on ESPN now. They're in bed business-wise with Disney. It's on ABC, which is wild from time to time. So obviously, like, there's not that much higher that you could go from there. But in terms of the money that they're generating, they've never been doing better. The gates, the pay-per-views, all that stuff and more. And of course, you know, they're now under the TKO umbrella with WWE. You see the deal that they just cut with Netflix. That's an insane deal. The UFC's deal is up by the end of 2025 here in America. What are they going to get? Because they're a proven commodity. They're on pay-per-view. They're one of the last, you know, they're one of the last entities that people are saying like, oh, it's a UFC pay-per-view, I'm paying. Obviously, the numbers will fluctuate, but, you know, the brand means so much. Like, UFC and WWE are the only two brands in combat sports, if you want to put UFC and WWE in that bucket, I would, that, you know, they announce, hey, we're coming to Sydney, they sell it out. As opposed to Top Rank, Matchroom, maybe to a degree AEW, that they're having their moments, but like, those guys need to announce the card. They need to announce the names, the fighters, right? If Top Rank says, we're coming to Newark, New Jersey, people are like, well, is Shakur Stevenson going to be on? If not, maybe I'm not going. UFC says we're coming to Newark, that thing is selling out in seconds. You know what I mean? And so the brand is just so on fire right now. The three letters are so on fire that I think they can continue to make money. They continue to, you know, break records and have the highest gate in this arena and that arena and pay-per-view numbers and all that. But like with anything in combat sports, it's always cyclical. You need stars, you need superstars. And if you have a super duper star like a Conor McGregor, you're going to be here. If you're, you know, missing a guy like that, maybe you'll be here. So it kind of goes peaks and valleys, but I don't think it's going anywhere. And I really think there's a lot more that they can do.
You previously covered the UFC for Fox and then for ESPN. Now, looking back on both tenures, was one experience better than the other? Did one support you as a journalist more than the other?
So two very different experiences, because when I was working for Fox from 2012 to 2016, I also had my day job, if you will, which was doing the stuff that I was doing for Vox Media, VOX, my show, The MMA Hour, writing for the website, et cetera, et cetera. And that was what was really paying the bills. The stuff that I was doing for Fox, it was once a week on a show called UFC Tonight, like a notebook type show, sort of like the way they use Jay Glazer, and then doing weigh-ins and post-fight show, pre-show for the big shows. So it kind of felt like that was just like ancillary work. Interestingly enough, the first meeting that I ever had with an executive at Fox in 2011, after they announced the deal that was going to start in 2012, one of the first questions I asked was, okay, you know, because I'm someone who pays attention a lot to the sports media business, and I know how things go when you're in bed financially with the entity that you're supposed to be covering.
Right.
I was like, okay, well, how's that going to work? And this individual said to me, like, you'll never be told not to say anything or not to report anything. And, you know, we're going to be independent and we're going to cover them like we cover any other sports entity, et cetera, et cetera. And over time, that obviously wasn't the case. Now, when I went to ESPN in 2018, I was all in. I didn't have any other jobs, right? So that was where I did my show, my podcast, my show on ESPN Plus, et cetera, et cetera, plus the pre-fight, the post-fight, all that stuff. And so it was a little bit easier for me when I was in the Fox era, because I had this other outlet where I could talk about whatever I want, which eventually got me in trouble, but I was able to talk about things like fighter pay, unfiltered things like the day-to-day minutia stuff that any sports talk host, sports media guy will, you know, any writer, any podcast, anyone is talking about. In our sport, it's a little bit more taboo, unfortunately. And at least I had that outlet. It finally came to a head, and they were asked to relieve me of my duties at Fox, but I was still able to keep the Vox job because it was completely independent. They were not in business with anyone. With ESPN, it got really, from the jump, it was increasingly difficult to cover the sport the way in which I wanted to cover the sport. And that's not the fault, by the way, of anyone at ESPN that I was working with. All fantastic people. And I think over the last 3 years since I left, people have kind of misconstrued my comments. They were never the roadblock. They always had my back. Unfortunately, they were dealing with an 800-pound gorilla who at times is very unpleasant to deal with. And you get a phone call yelling, screaming, all that stuff. You're going to say, you know what? Could we just chill on the fighter pay talk or something like that for a bit? You know what I mean? They just want peace. And I get that. And my work was becoming like a thorn in their side because of the feedback that they were getting. So towards the end, I was feeling quite soulless. And I just didn't want to feel like I was being filtered anymore or being censored. And so that's why I felt like it was right for me to go.
So do you now prefer being more of an independent journalist, or like, did you at least enjoy, were there benefits to having the support and the backing of a larger company at times?
Dream come true to work for ESPN. I don't regret it for a second. First time I'm on SportsCenter, first time I'm on ESPN Radio, OTL, E60. Like, this literally was my dream. Yeah. My dream was to work for ESPN, the worldwide leader. I'm a kid from Montreal. How the hell did I end up here? And not only did they gave me one show, two shows, three shows. I had three shows by the time I was done. And all very popular shows that people talk about to me till this day. So they supported me. Not only that, I really wanted to be a part of their basketball coverage, their NBA coverage. I just walked into Tim Corrigan's office, who is the EP of NBA on ESPN, and said, hey, you don't know me, but I love the NBA. I'd love to be a part of your coverage. If you ever need someone in a pinch, I'll be your guy. He said, yes, I don't know you, but I love that you've done this. In 20 plus years, no one has ever come to my office and said this. If something comes up, I'll reach out. And lo and behold, he did reach out 6 months later. He gave me a shot to do three summer league games. And then I got to do around 12 actual NBA games, which was insane. Like, how did this happen? Going to ESPN, it's almost like you're reading that old book. I don't know if you've ever read it. Choose Your Adventure, where you can, like, once you're in, you can really try to go, like, I pitched a story to E60. No, like, this wasn't part of my job. I pitched them an ESPN radio show. You can really create your own destiny. So that was all great. But it just became tough, and I was not loving it anymore because there were so many restrictions and so much drama. And you know, my detractors like to say that ESPN fired me. They didn't fire me. I had a 3-year deal. They offered me a new deal. It was for the exact same money. And I just felt like, you know, maybe it's time to go elsewhere and do something else.
When you went to ESPN, did you anticipate there being some of those roadblocks, and or were you kind of surprised by it?
Initially, no, because I signed with ESPN in April of 2021. My contract only began in June. The UFC deal was announced in May. So I just thought that I was being brought on to beef up their MMA coverage. They only had one person at the time covering it, but I didn't know that they were about to sign a deal with UFC. And the initial deal, if you look back through history, the initial deal was they were just going to air 10 events. It was like 10 to 12 events on Plus. And then a subsequent press release came out and said, no, they're getting the entire UFC deal beginning in 2019. So I went from being like, oh, you know, I'm just being brought in. This is a dream. I'm going to get to cover the UFC MMA for ESPN, to, oh, wow, they actually have part of the TV deal, to, oh, wow, they're the full home of the, you know, the exclusive home of the UFC in the US. And then I go back to just a couple of years prior, my experience working for the exclusive home of the UFC in America, that's Fox, and it did not end well. So the first thing I did was, you know, call my agent, Nick Khan, who I was like, am I in trouble? Like, am I done? And I learned later on that when they signed the deal, they tried to get ESPN to renege on the deal before it started. Like, they were very well aware that I had signed, because by then it had been out. And, you know, they tried to say, like, can you boot this guy before the whole thing starts? And to ESPN's credit, everyone involved, from Jimmy Pitaro to Norby to everyone in the, you know, the executive side of things, they didn't even know me. They hadn't even met me, and they said no. So I was very thankful for that, because that would have been devastating.
But you ended up walking away from an offer from ESPN.
Yes,
when you left.
Yes, they offered me something, I think around February, March of 2021. My deal was up in June of 2021, and honestly, I was going to take it, and I was only going to take it, if I'm being 1,000% honest with you, in spite of Dana White. That was, I knew he wanted me to go, and I said to myself, well, you know what? I'm a petty person. I'll stick around just to piss them off. And actually, around that time, I started to talk to a therapist, because I was feeling very conflicted, because that's not a reason to stick around anywhere. And it felt like week after week, like the clouds were opening up in my brain. And then I kind of came to this conclusion, like, well, this is very silly, and I want to go where I'm happy, and I want to go back to the old me. And that's why I ended up going back to my old show, but also adding, I realized that I had the ability to essentially look at my career as a, you know, as a puzzle, as a pie, and I could slice it up in many different ways and get the opportunity to work for many different people. And it's been incredible. And again, no animosity. I think ESPN has been the greatest thing to ever happen to the UFC. And I really loved the people that I worked with. It was not their fault. It just wasn't the best fit, you know, given my relationship, or whatever you want to call it. And it's not one that I want to have. I just only know one way to cover the sport, and that's just honestly. And I would argue that 98% of the stuff I talk about for about 13 to 14 hours a week is very positive and promoting the UFC. But sometimes you do have to talk about the underbelly and the not so positive things. And I just view that as sports. And I think sometimes they view that as me being personal, and it's not personal for me.
Why is the ESPN deal so important for the UFC?
On so many levels. I mean, that was, you know, I always used to say during the Fox days, like, ESPN, while the UFC was in business with Fox, was like the blonde girl at the end of the bar that that they really had their eye on. They were on a date, but they didn't really like that date. Like, they really wanted to be with that girl. That was the one they always wanted to be with. And they finally got with that girl. And it's been incredible on so many different levels. Like, just like when you go to ESPN.com on a fight night, you see it on the front page, like the first, you know how it is. If ESPN is in business with someone, they're going to start covering it more.
Sure.
It's on the ticker. You're watching like UNC Duke, and it's like there's a little like promo there with the guys. Like, that's absurd for someone who's been watching the sport at a time when it was banned on pay-per-view. Like, you couldn't even get it on pay-per-view. Now you're getting it. You open the app and it like hits you right in the face. They've just made it a part of the conversation along with the NFL and the NBA, et cetera. And, you know, when I was covering the sport, kids in high school didn't care about this. Now I have my nephews who are, you know, in 10th grade, 11th grade. All they want to talk to me about is the UFC. All they want to talk about are the pay-per-views. They're talking to me about the fight nights that like that, you know, the casuals aren't watching. Like, it's just, they've done such a great job of making it a part of the sports conversation in this country. No one else could have done that. Fox tried with FS1. The UFC was helping them out, I felt, more so than Fox helping out the UFC. Here, it's been such a mutually beneficial relationship. Plus, they got the UFC exclusively on ESPN Plus pay-per-view, which I think has really, you know, upped the value of ESPN Plus. I think the UFC is carrying ESPN Plus on its back. It's been the best thing that they've produced and done. And so you see there's a trickle-down effect there. So I think everyone wins when it comes to this relationship. I'm fascinated to see what happens this time next year, maybe a little bit later towards the end of 2025 when the deal is officially up, because I think it would be brilliant for them to stay. But also, like I said, there's the Netflix of the world, the Apples, the Amazons, you name them. I think the UFC is going to be a very hot commodity.
But you think the UFC recognizes the value that ESPN offers to them just as much as you just laid it out?
I think so. And I've had no real like inside info on this,
yeah.
But I think it would have to be like an astronomical pay raise to leave, because for it's different than WWE. WWE is sports entertainment. Like, ESPN isn't covering, even if they did a deal with ESPN, they're not covering it on SportsCenter. It's not on the front page of .com. UFC wants to be a part of that conversation, along with the NFL and the NBA, et cetera. And if you leave that, I wonder if you're still part of that conversation. Now, I know the sports media business is evolving, changing rapidly, but it's still ESPN. And I just think with the app and with Plus and with the linear channel, it just gives them a lot. So maybe there's a world where they break it up. Maybe ESPN is getting like the pay-per-views and the fight nights are going somewhere else. But I would personally be very surprised if ESPN is no longer in the UFC business by the end of this deal.
Can you point to one main reason as to why your relationship with Dana White fell off? Like, was it the reporting that Brock Lesnar was coming back?
No.
Was it the talking about fighter pay and talking about things that, like you mentioned, they considered negative?
Yeah.
And
There's no smoking gun. There's no like incident. There's no story. Yeah. The truth is, from the moment I met Dana White in 2009, the first time I interviewed him at UFC 97 in Montreal, coincidentally where I'm from, up until 2016, when the whole banning, situation happened, I had a really great relationship with him. So much so that I remember not that long before the banning incident, I remember having a conversation with him where one of the PR people at the UFC got mad at me for reporting something. And I remember this like it was yesterday, because he was getting his kids ready to school. And like, I could just tell like he was like a little bit distracted. And I was like, oh, Dana White's just like us. You know, it's hectic getting your kids ready for school. And I remember him saying like, people in this company are going to get mad at you for reporting things, but that's your job. Don't forget that's your job. So don't listen to those people. You got it right. You had the info correct. F them, do your thing. And I remember thinking like, oh, Dana White will never get mad at me for reporting something. This is fantastic. Now, what happened was his business partner and best friend, Lorenzo Fertitta, who was the money man along with his brother, Frank Fertitta, their family owned the Station Casinos. They're incredibly successful people business-wise. He used to listen to my show all the time and was really, he's a very sharp guy. He's a very smart guy and like really like looked at everything going on in the space. Dana is kind of like all over the place and maybe wasn't watching and listening to everything. And Lorenzo would keep telling Dana, like, this guy, he's not loyal to us. He's talking about fight or pay. Like, why do you like this guy so much? Why do you have, I think Dana liked me until the very, very end. But I think it was Lorenzo, the one who was not a fan of mine and didn't like that I talked about the business, you know, like I said, free agency, the competition, Bellator, et cetera. So much so that when Dana banned me, when they brought me to the back at UFC 199 in the forum to tell me that I was gone, he said, his quote was, Lorenzo just put a bullet in your head. Your career is over. And so that, like, you know, was more fuel to my theory that, like, he was just kind of doing what his friend, you know, told him to do, his business partner. Now, I know now he doesn't really love me. Like, you know, the relationship, I haven't talked to him in almost 8 years, which blows my mind. But it was just a buildup of them feeling like I was not a team player, so to speak. But we've never had that conversation. I was never a team. I was never supposed to be a team player. I'm a journalist, you know? And I think that they get, I don't know, maybe they wanted me to be something that I didn't want to be. It's a shame. And when I went to ESPN, I was asked to reach out to try to mend the fences. And I didn't really want to, because I didn't really feel like I should be the one doing that, because I'm the one who lost out on employment and money and opportunities. They just kept swimming along, but I did it anyway to be a good soldier. And I never heard back. And all I heard were headaches and issues and problems and roadblocks and all that stuff, to the point that I, you know, decided that I didn't want to be a part of that ecosystem anymore. They made it very difficult for me towards the end. I wasn't allowed to enter the arena the same way that, you know, my colleagues were entering. I had to go through the back. It was just like, I felt lesser than human. It was bizarre. And all for what? You know, just because they didn't like the idea of me being around. Now, there is some revisionist history out there. People still think that I'm banned by the UFC and that I've been banned since 2016. I was banned for 48 hours. I didn't miss a single event. I was banned at UFC 199 and I was brought back 48 hours later, and I was at 200 and 201 and 202 and 203. And I was at all the events when I was working for ESPN. My last event was in March of 2020. 3 days later, the pandemic hits and none of us traveled. And then actually, coincidentally, my first event back was supposed to be in June of 2021. Once things started to open up, they had an event in Arizona, but then the contract was up and I was done. And when I left, I said to myself that I don't want to go back.
You haven't requested a UFC credential?
No, I have not applied for a UFC credential since March of 2020, since UFC 248, I believe that was. Yoel Romero, Israel Adesanya. Now, you may reach out to them and say, hey, is Ariel allowed? And they may say, F him. No, but I have not been denied.
Yeah.
I'm sure they wouldn't roll out the red carpet. I have not applied. And I have no intent on applying, only because I didn't like the way I was feeling and the way I was treated when I was there. And I came to the conclusion that I don't need to be there to do my job.
Yeah.
Clearly. And so that's it. No hard feelings. Like I said, my life is devoted to talking about this sport, and I think I do so in a very positive manner. It's just unfortunate that for whatever reason, we're not the best of pals.
Do you miss going to events, or do you think there's going to be a point in your career where you miss going to events?
You know, there's great value when you're climbing the ranks, being at the events for multiple reasons. You get to develop relationships, sources, meet fighters, etc. And I've had great moments at events, you know, interview moments and whatnot. Being a younger journalist now covering the UFC is a little more challenging because they don't allow you to do the one-on-ones that I sort of became famous for. They do like these sort of like mini scrums at a dais, one fighter at a time. So unless you kind of have these relationships and you could go to a hotel room, it's hard to kind of break from the pack. So yeah. there's not a ton of value there for me. There's nothing like, you know, big event, Vegas, the buzz, you get to interview Conor McGregor. Like, it was incredible. All that was a dream for me. But honestly, now, you know, I've been able to be a little bit more selective with my travel. I'm still traveling a ton, especially lately, doing a lot more boxing, which was all part of the plan. And one of the things that I got frustrated with towards the end of my time at ESPN, I was offered to do the Jake Paul Ben Askren fight in April of 2021. And they told me I couldn't. I just wanted the ability to kind of do whatever I want and do fun, different things. So I still get the itch. I get to scratch the itch of being at events and the buzz and all that stuff. I was just, you know, at the Anthony Joshua, Francis Ngannou fight, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So I don't necessarily miss that. And feel like I'm, you know, having FOMO or anything like that. And again, it's just because I didn't like the, I used to come home on Sundays and feel utterly depressed because I felt like shit after these, excuse me for swearing, but I felt like I just wasn't being treated fairly and I didn't quite feel like that was right. And so I just don't want to put myself in that position, at least on now. Never say never. I'm not planting my flag and saying I'm never going back. Who the hell knows what the future will hold, but it doesn't feel necessary at the moment for me.
How are you perceived by, I mean, obviously you're very popular within the UFC world, but how are you perceived by UFC fans, at least in terms of your relationship with Dana White? Like, do most people seem to think that Dana has been too sensitive over the issue, or do a lot of them side with Dana?
You know, Dana's a very popular guy, and I think that there are some fans who think that I'm too negative towards the UFC, which is laughable to me because, again, I bet you if you sat down and watched a full week's worth of shows for me, all how many hours, 10, 11 hours, and you really broke it down minute by minute, I would strongly argue that it's like 95 to 98% positive. But because I'm not afraid to speak up when I think things are negative or being critical, whatever, and no one else really does, you know, for various reasons, it tends to stand out more. You know what I mean? And so I'll see it, like I'll do a whole show and then they'll clip off one thing and it's me being critical of something, the main event for UFC 300. Like, oh, of course Ariel's being a hater. I'm like, really? Did you not watch the whole damn show where I was talking about how great the upcoming fights were and this and that? So like, there's obviously a bit of a label put on me. And because of the history, and like I said, there's newer fans and they have this revisionist history where they think I've been banned since 2016. And I see it all the time. Like even just today, I reported the news that Bellator signed a deal with Max. On my show yesterday, I was talking about this and I said, you know, the news is coming out tomorrow. I was asked not to report it, so I was told off the record, but it's a new player in the MMA streaming game and you'll find out tomorrow. And I saw a bunch of people commenting like, oh, wow, if only Ariel kept the secret about Brock Lesnar. I was never told the Brock Lesnar secret. That too is a story that has been twisted and like no one ever told me not to report it. You know how many times over my career I've been told things off the record and kept those in the vault? Like, you wouldn't last a year in this business if you were blurting out things that were told to you off the record. So that's another sort of revisionist history point that annoys me. But overall, I think the fans appreciate the journey and have had my back and continue to have my back. And sometimes we could get bogged down on the negative trolls or comments or whatever, but I am very, very lucky. And they saved me. If not for them speaking up in 2016, I would have never been, you know, unbanned, if you will. And 1,000% was all the fans. So I will always be grateful for that.
And I know you mentioned that ESPN had at one point asked you to reach out to Dana, which you did and you never heard from him. But do you know if ESPN, when they were fielding complaints about you from Dana White, did they ever attempt to foster that conversation? Do you know if they tried?
I don't know if they ever said like, hey, would you like to sit down with him? But I know they had my back. I really do. I know of one story where Dana White was complaining that I was being too negative going into a pay-per-view. And what was amazing about it was, you know, he probably saw a clip. Someone's probably showed him something. I don't know what it was. And it was a particular card. I remember what it was. It was in Anaheim. It was Daniel Cormier against Stipe Miocic and Nate Diaz versus Anthony Pettis. And it just so happened to be a fight card and a particular fight between Diaz and Pettis where I was very excited for it. And I remember I was on SportsCenter and I said, if this fight doesn't live up to the hype that I am generating on the air here, I want you guys to never allow me back on SportsCenter again. Like, that's how excited I was about the fight. So anyway, that's just one example. So Dana White says, you know what, Ariel's being too negative. This is bad for business. He's ruining the pay-per-views, all nonsense. And so what a couple of the producers did, and they only told me after the fact, they tried to shield me from most of this stuff, which I appreciated. They put together a highlight reel of all the stuff that I was saying leading up to that particular card that was overly positive, just to prove to the powers that be, Jimmy Pitaro and company, that this was not true. And so like, what? And they're like, it couldn't have worked out better. Cause like, there you are on SportsCenter saying, if this fight doesn't live up to the hype that I'm generating, ban me from SportsCenter. That's how excited, this is how great it's going to be. So it was a very easy thing. So just an example where I felt like they had my back, towards the end, I think everyone was a little bit exhausted of the relationship. And I think that, you know, I think the people that I worked with were sad that I left. At least they seemed to be when I spoke to them, but I think they understood as well, because it just stopped being fun, unfortunately.
So does Dana, like, would he prefer if the UFC could control every headline that is out there about them? Like are there journalists and mainstream media outlets independent of the UFC that don't have a relationship with him that he respects and gets along with?
Yeah. I mean, his relationship with the media has always been a little bit contentious. He has banned other journalists before. And they remained banned, unfortunately. And you know, I just don't think that's the best way to go about things. But you know, that's the way he feels. You know, it's his property. He could do whatever the hell he wants with it. Now his new thing is that he's very open to talking to, like, the influencers, the YouTubers, people like that, which I have no beef with. People try to get me to talk bad about them. Like, I appreciate actually people who are trying to make a name for themselves and are doing a great job of that and creating their own lanes. Like, being a media member in 2024 isn't what it was in 2004, 2014, 2020. Like, it keeps changing. He seems to like the sort of bro-y YouTube guys, and God bless. He's not doing a ton of, you know, hard-hitting interviews, but, you know, he doesn't really need to. He's speaking to his audience through those people. He's speaking to his audience through his press conferences and whatnot, through his own social media, and he just... you know, he doesn't feel like the MMA media serves much of a great purpose to him. What I have always thought was a little bit funny was, you know, Dana likes to say that the MMA media are scumbags and we're lowlifes and we're douchebags and we're the worst of the worst. And, you know, that's essentially, for all intents and purposes, those are the people that cover your sport and your organization on a day-to-day basis. If we are those people, what does that say about your entity? Like, these are the people that have chosen to devote their careers to covering you. The other people come and go, but we're the ones day after day talking about all the UFC events and all the fighters and all that stuff. And I just feel like it's weird to talk so poorly of those people, but I feel like he doesn't look at it the same way.
Deep down, do you think Dana White feels that your career has...
Does he miss me? Yes.
Does he, looking at your career, does he think that you've ultimately been... good or bad for the UFC?
Look, I've joked in the past that if I walked outside right now and got hit by a bus, I think he would celebrate. I think he would be very happy if I was no longer here.
It's not just shtick.
No, I think it's reached a point where over the years, like, I just think he despises me. Yeah. I would again, I know for a fact there is no reason. If someone asks Dana White how, you know, why do you not like Ariel, or what is it? I think he'll just say, like, he's a douchebag, he's a scumbag, but there's no actual story.
Right.
So I've become like this thing. And so, you know, I think he probably thinks that, like, he contributed to my success and that I should be more grateful for that. Mm-hmm. And I have said time and again, like, he was gigantic for me. Like, he gave me those interviews, he gave me scoops, things like that. Like, and I felt like I was very grateful. I just, you know, I wanted to be, you know, Howard Cosell was my hero, and he's the guy who told it like it is. So I just wanted to tell it like it is. And again, I, for those that may not be MMA fans, like, I wasn't talking about, you know, salacious things, personal things, the underbelly of MMA. I was just talking about transactional things, no different than all the podcasts I listened to and whatnot. So none of it was ever personal. All I think could have been very much avoided, but, you know, maybe one day down the line, we'll shake hands again. And as I've always said as well, even if he never wants to talk to me ever again, he doesn't have to. He has talked to me a lot over the years. It's fine. I just ultimately just want to be able to do my job in peace, you know, do the shows, entertain the people, be an escape for people. And I'm allowed to do that. So I really have no complaints. Like, people love to ask me about these things and harp on them, but, like, I really have no complaints about my relationship with UFC or lack thereof, because I leave them alone and they leave me alone and we're all good. And I feel like I contribute to the coverage of the sport, and they may want to benefit from that or not. I don't know, or acknowledge it, but it's all good. As long as I could do my job and everyone's happy, then I'm at peace.
What did you think about Alexander Lee asking Sean Strickland a couple months ago. And I should say that that's Alexander Lee of MMAfighting.com. He asked Sean Strickland about anti-LGBTQ social media posts that he had made. As somebody who has been in those types of press conferences where you're asking fighters questions, what did you think about the decision to ask that question and then the response that it garnered?
Yeah, I mean, I really had no problem with the question because, like I said, those fighters, especially to especially at a level like Sean and to someone like AK Lee, who I've been working with for a very long time and have known for a very long time, he's not made available. So, like, you know, could you say, oh, that's a question that you ask in a one-on-one? Yeah, sure. But he's not getting in one-on-one, and that's a topic that is important to him. And he wanted to know if Sean's views had changed over the years. Also, I've heard people say, like, hey, time and place, right? He's there to promote a fight. I get that, but that's not Sean Strickland. I would strongly argue that he probably prefers to talk about everything but fighting. He showed up to that press day wearing a t-shirt that was not fight related. I don't want to misquote it, but it was something about like guns and women in the kitchen and all that stuff. Like you're sort of inviting that type of talk. And so, you know, it didn't really seem to bother Alex, and I don't think it bothered Sean so much so that he posted the clip on his social media. Alex didn't even acknowledge it afterwards. So like everyone else had a say about it. Everyone else got all crazy about it. And, you know, it is what it is. Do I wish it was a little bit less, you know, intense and hateful? Sure. But like these are fighters. They're outlandish characters, colorful characters. And Sean is at the top of that list. Dana White loves to say that, you know, we don't censor and all that stuff. And yes, that is true. There was a time, though, where there were ramifications for things that you said, and that has evolved over the years for whatever reason. And I do think that when you're a preeminent sports organization, there are probably certain things that you shouldn't say, especially with such vitriol. But, you know, they have made the decision to be the uncancelable sport. I don't think it has to be one or the other. I don't think it has to be one extreme or the other. I just think there needs to be like some kind of line, but I don't think that line exists anymore. And so be it. So in the end, I say, fine, it's fine and fair to ask that question. And those were Sean's feelings, and you have to take his feelings and do whatever you want with them. Either you're like, yeah, that's my guy, or you're like, okay, that's someone I don't really want to root for, and you kind of move on. I don't really get offended all that much. I'm not one of these media members who likes to like go around and preach and tell people how to feel about things. That's the fight game. Those are colorful characters. You ask that question, you have to be ready for the answer.
So what about Dana then citing freedom of speech afterwards, and just considering the fact that you've had issues of being censored or Dana attempting to censor you, and then him saying freedom of speech for the fighters?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of work for him, so it's a little bit different. You can poke holes in it all you want, and there's a gazillion videos of him saying like, you can't say that about these people, and you can't talk like that, and we've suspended this person. Like, I did a whole thing on my show going through a bunch of different examples over the years, but things have changed. And they probably changed around 2016 or so. And they really changed around 2020 when the UFC was one of the first sports entities to come back. And I think they realized like, hey, we could be that sport for the people who feel like they're being, you know, censored or being told what to feel or say and all that. And they've leaned all the way in, and that's fine. And there's definitely a market to attract by doing that. I still think that there's like some kind of line. There always has to be a line somewhere in all walks of life, but they don't feel that way. And I would probably say that the line, like, look, the line is ultimately business. Meaning, if the UFC has a deal with Venom, it's a clothing company, and they make the uniforms and all that stuff for the fighters. If a fighter goes up there and says, I hate Venom, their stuff sucks, I don't feel good wearing it, blah, 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 I guarantee you there'll be ramifications, right? So when it affects the business, there are repercussions. Just that fight week, that particular fight week that we're talking about, there was a fighter named Arnold Allen who showed up to the press conference wearing Nikes. Well, they have an exclusive shoe deal with Under Armour, with the Rocks Under Armour brand. So he had to tape up the swoosh. So like that's censoring, right? So when it comes to business, when it comes to the bottom line, then there are repercussions. But when it comes to like, hey, we're the uncancelable sport, you could say what you want, we're not going to be woke, it's the Wild West. So, you know, I know what that is. I think most sensible people know what's what. And you just kind of have to decide what to get worked up over, what to not get worked up over. I choose not to get worked up over what fighters say as it pertains to these topics or any other topic, because I don't view them as the moral compass in my life. I'm not looking to them to tell me how to feel or what to think or anything like that. So they're fighters. They're unique characters. I appreciate them for what they do in the cage. And there are some that I really appreciate for what they stand for and believe in and how they live their lives outside. And that's just how I, you know, proceed.
I think back to ESPN's response to some of the offensive things that Kyrie Irving has said over the years, and then their lack of a response to the things that Sean Strickland had said just recently. Why do you think ESPN is more apt to criticizing teams, athletes, owners in other sports that they do have business relationships with than they are the UFC?
It is a weird one. I would say that you have to look at the UFC more as like a sports team as opposed to a league, meaning the ESPN isn't in business with Mark Cuban. So when they're criticizing or Joe Tsai, like when they're criticizing Kyrie, they don't really have to answer to Joe or Cuban or whomever he's playing for. And I know Adam Silver has thoughts, and there's famous stories about David Stern having issues with broadcasters and whatnot, as opposed to if you say something about the UFC, like that's a Dana White phone call, right? Because he's the owner, essentially. I know there's a ton of other people, but that's kind of the way it's constructed. So that's one thing. And, you know, it's easier to tell a lower level person than Stephen A or someone like that how to feel and what to say and what to think. And from what I've heard, these phone calls aren't incredibly pleasant. And so maybe you just want to try to do whatever you can to avoid it. But yes, if you look at it like that, I mean, I experienced this. Gina Carano was someone who was on The Mandalorian. She is someone that I was incredibly close to and gave me a lot of time, and I covered her. She was a pioneer and it still is. Trailblazer. In 2021, she was getting very vocal about the pandemic and about the restrictions and whatnot. And she posted a meme that was equating being a Republican in 2021 to being a Jew living in Nazi Germany. And, you know, at first I didn't want to touch it. I felt weird about it. People kept asking me what I thought about it. It turned into a whole thing. She got in trouble with Disney and eventually she got let go. And then eventually I like put a video together. I posted a video on my Instagram because I felt like, all right, this is an MMA story. It pertains to Jewish people. I'm Jewish, proudly Jewish. So I felt like, okay, you know, people know my relationship with Gina. I'm going to talk about it. And I was very clear in the video. I don't want her canceled. I don't think she should be, you know, fired or suspended or anything. Like I'm trying to explain to you all why this may be offensive. That's it. Yeah. I'm not asking for anything. I'm not trying to change anyone's life. The next day, Dana White was asked about her situation and unprompted, he said, did you guys see that video from Ariel Helwani? Which I would venture, he has me blocked on all social media. So I don't even know how he saw it or if someone showed it to him or told him what I said. He's like, what a douchebag. What a douchebag making it about himself. I was like, I'm not making this about myself. I'm trying to explain to you why Jewish people. Anyway, that turned into a whole thing. And it snowballed to the point where a lot of sports media people were saying like, how could ESPN not have Ariel's back? Imagine if during, you know, 2020, everything that was going on with Black Lives Matter, imagine if a reporter, if there was someone out there who was critical of it and a reporter stood up and said like, no, this is actually why we feel this way and are offended. And imagine if a white owner then said, you're a douchebag for saying that, right? Imagine if a African-American personality on ESPN would have said something about that time and someone who was not African-American spoke up and was like, nah, you're a douchebag. You're making this all about yourself. What do you think the response would have been? Right? What do you think it would have been? You tell me.
I think it would have been far different than
it would have been a freaking explosion, right? In the end, they posted a statement. They gave it to a bunch of outlets, maybe even you guys as well. And they just said, like, Ariel's a great journalist and a valued colleague. And that was it. Like, there was no real reprimanding of what he said. In my heart, that's when I kind of knew, like, my time here is probably done. Mm-hmm. It's probably best for me to start looking elsewhere, because that made me sad. Because all I was trying to do, if you look at the video, I was just trying to explain why this could be deemed offensive. That was it. And so I didn't think, as a Jewish person and as an MMA personality, this was as in my wheelhouse as it gets. It was an MMA fighter talking about the, I didn't think that was deserved. And it would have been nice if, you know, someone had my back, but it didn't happen.
Being that you used to have a good relationship with Dana White, what's Dana White's best quality?
Oh man, he's incredibly talented. He's incredibly driven. He's incredibly hardworking. The UFC isn't a thing in 2024 without him. If the Fertittas buy the UFC and don't put in 2000 and don't put Dana White as the face of the company, as the promoter of the company, I don't know if it survives. There's all these stories about, you know, 3-4 years in, they're $44 million in the hole. Like, he freaking bled, sweat, teared his way to the top. And that's the thing, like, find me any clip where I call him a bad name or insult him or anything like that. Yeah. I spoke up about, you know, the video that came out last year. I felt uncomfortable doing so. I waited a couple days to do so because that's a personal thing. And I don't, you know, I feel like there's a line as well. I try to view him as an entity that I'm covering. And even though it's become personal over the years in terms of like the jobs and whatnot, I've tried not to allow that to, you know, taint my reporting or my feelings and views on the organization. If there wasn't a UFC, I wouldn't be living this dream or this life. So, and he's the reason for that. So, incredibly smart, transformed a sport. I would say transformed the fight game, because now you're starting to see boxing finally copy some of the things that they've done. And I think they should have done so a long time ago. Some promoters like Eddie Hearn of Matchroom is always talking about how he looks up to Dana White, and he should. Now you're seeing what they're doing with like their Performance Institute and the Apex and all that. They're ahead of the curve. So, it's an incredible success story. This guy was a bellman at a hotel and teaching, you know, Tai Bo, before all this started. And now he's arguably the most successful promoter of the 21st century and one of the greatest promoters of all time, in the same conversation as McMahon, Aram, King, you know, those guys, like, yeah, the giants. So yeah, anyone who says otherwise is just being a hater.
What's your relationship with Joe Rogan like?
I have not seen Joe in quite some time. The first few times that like I saw him, and I couldn't even believe that he knew who I was. Like, he went out of his way to give me props, to show me love. I got to do a video interview with him backstage at one of his shows in like 2010. And he impromptu showed me a lot of love. The only issue that I've ever, and even till this day, like, I see some people being like, oh, enough of Joe Rogan. Like, are you crazy? They have one of the most famous broadcasters on the planet calling UFC fights. Like, Joe should have that job until he decides that he doesn't want to do it anymore. He's a massive asset to the UFC, and it would be crazy for them to ever part ways. And I don't think they would ever part ways as long as Dana White is around. The only issue that I ever had with him was in 2016, the Monday after my banning, before I was unbanned, he went on his podcast, incredibly successful and obviously not as big back then as it was now, but it was still gigantic. And he said this whole story that I was brought into a room and told not to say anything, and I was shown the promo. None of that ever happened. A complete lie. And I know that it came from Dana White to try to like justify what happened. None of that ever happened. There was never a conversation. I got this just like any other reporter gets news, two sources, blah, blah, blah. Actually, for this one, it was three. No one from the UFC, no one from Fox, no one from, I wasn't even working for Fox anymore. I had no knowledge that it was even going to be broken that night. I just had a massive story and the fight was in a month and I didn't even know who the opponent was. I just knew that Brock was coming back. That was it. So I felt like that was very damaging to my credibility and to my story. And as I just said earlier, till this day, people parrot that. And yeah, I think it's because he said it. So I responded on Twitter, and I think I've talked about it in other places. I really didn't appreciate that because it was just very, you know, it was very reckless to do this. My life. I thought I was done. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen. So that really hurt me. Since then, you know, I've heard him talk about me on his show and he's been nice, you know, no issues, no pot shots, no nothing. And I've never thrown one his way. And in fact, he has my uncle on his show quite often. My uncle is a professor named Gad Saad. And it's kind of wild that he's on all the time. I've never been on and that's totally fine. I don't think I will ever be on, but so to answer your question in a long-winded way, like, do I have a relationship with him? I don't really think so. He's been on my show back in the day. I've obviously met him. He knows who I am. We've talked about, I just was bummed about that moment, but like, I don't hold on to these things. Life is too short for that. So in the moment I spoke up about it, but as I sit here talking to you today, like, he is incredible at what he does. He's an inspiration really to all media guys, especially if you want to be independent podcasters, whatever. And I think he's a huge asset to the sport and the UFC.
But you never had a conversation with him about the Brock Lesnar report?
In the aftermath?
Yeah.
No, I didn't see him. I didn't talk to him. I tweeted about it, but right. We never really crossed paths after that. Grubby, like, yo, man, what the fuck? You know?
Yeah.
I didn't have his number at that time, so.
Does UFC have a lot of fans who are young, like the NFL and kids, I should say, like the NFL is putting games on Nickelodeon. I can't imagine the UFC ever doing something like that, but there is still also the goal of kind of trying to, yeah,
I could see it. Yeah. Why not? I mean, wrestling has taken many different turns, you know, is it in the works? No. But, you know, they're in bed with Disney. Who would have ever thought that was going to happen? You know what I mean? Yeah. So to answer your question, yes. And I think like some of the Jake Paul stuff has made, you know, combat sports a little bit more appealing to youngsters. But like I said, like never did any high school kid ever want to talk to me. I just spoke to my alma mater, my high school alma mater in Montreal in December. And all these kids, like I was just thinking like, there's no way these kids, 10th graders, 11th graders, these kids aren't going to know who I am. And they're all asking me all these crazy questions about MMA and Conor McGregor and all this stuff. I'm like, wow, you know, in the 10th grade, when I was in the 10th grade, it was 1998. So no one knew what the UFC was. And I didn't think that it had kind of reached that point. But I think it's because of the ESPN deal, because they made it so, quote unquote, mainstream. All these kids are being exposed to it. And now, you know, they have the video game and all this stuff. Like it's just like anything else. So yeah, it's getting a lot younger and that's a bit surprising.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier about covering boxing and you recently went to Saudi Arabia to cover a boxing match, which is something that you previously had declined to do. And I know you explained this on your podcast, the reasoning for why you went, but were you at all concerned by going that you were going to be accused of sports washing or people just kind of assuming that you were now on the Saudis payroll or something like that?
No, because I'm not on the Saudis payroll and I was just there to cover an event. If you looked at my coverage, I wasn't there saying like, come to Saudi Arabia, doing like tourism spots for them or hashtag ad or anything like that. Like I was strictly there to cover a gigantic fight between Anthony Joshua and Francis Ngannou. I didn't really even talk about it much beforehand and didn't talk a ton about the experience after, but I did talk about this as you mentioned on the show, because when Jake Paul fought Tommy Fury in February of 2023, I said that I wasn't 100% comfortable given the history, you know, given my religion, all that stuff going over there. And in October, I was asked to go. And that fight fell on my daughter's birthday. And I always made a promise to my kids that I would never miss a birthday. The Fury fight was actually a week after my son's birthday, but it would have made me maybe have to leave on his birthday if my memory serves me correct. So it just didn't feel right. And then this one came around. And by then, from February of last year to now, I've gone to meet a lot of people who are behind the scenes over there. People who live in Saudi, people who don't live in Saudi, London, etc. People who work for DAZN. All these people were not people that I knew this time last year. And I got to ask a gazillion questions, probably to the point where they were getting annoyed of me. And they were all very upfront and honest. And I felt a lot more comfortable just like physically going there.
Sure.
So, you know, to me, and I got to learn more about their intentions. I got to learn more about how sincere it all is. Talk to the fighter. I mean, I couldn't have talked to more people because I'd be lying if I didn't say I was nervous, anxious, just for my own sake. But also, you know, I knew people would be like, oh, why'd you change your mind? What this, that. But yep. I could say, like I said on my show, not paid by anyone other than DAZN, not one who accepted anything, didn't do anything on the side, wasn't told to say anything, wasn't told to not say anything, wasn't told to post this, not post that. I mean, look at all the coverage. Very little was about the location. It was all about the fight. And that's what I would do if I was in Puerto Rico, which I was the week before, or in Vegas, or in Atlanta, Chicago, etc. So I don't know how anyone could accuse me of that. People change. I learn more. That's what journalists are supposed to do. And that's not, you know, saying that, you know, the history isn't what it is. I just feel like, all right, I got to learn about the state of things, the safety, and also what their actual true intentions are. And with all of that, I felt very comfortable with going in. I can tell you that was treated very well, was treated, let's be honest, it's not a great time for Jewish people right now. And I'm constantly anxious. And I couldn't have felt more welcome, safer, you know, them appreciating that I was there. And no one ever put me in an awkward spot. No one ever told me to say anything. It was a very pleasant experience and a memorable one.
The last thing as we wrap up here is you've said that you want to be the best interviewer in sports. What's the biggest thing that you do to get better as an interviewer?
Yeah, that's a great question. In a perfect world, I'd like to be known as the greatest interviewer of all time. I don't know if I have the time to do that, but there's nothing that excites me more about a big interview than in a big interview, I should say. Like, there's the art of interviewing, all these things, fascinating to me. And I feel like I'm constantly listening to interviews and studying them in my brain and critiquing them, because I love the challenge of getting someone to open up and getting someone to almost forget that they're doing an interview. It's just two people talking. The person that I admired the most growing up as far as their interviewing skills was Howard Stern, because I felt like no one did a better job of getting people to let their guard down.
Sure.
And so, you know, now I feel like I've developed my own style, but, you know, I would be lying if I said that, like, I feel like I perfected it. I'm very, very critical of myself. And I'm constantly like critiquing myself, whether it's during the fact, after the fact, etc. But I'm also listening to a lot of other people and learning things about, you know, asking the right kind of questions, about getting in, getting out, not making them long-winded, being well-researched. And I'm really trying to challenge myself. Like, this summer, I'm covering the Olympics for the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. I got to do 9 or so sit-downs in December with the Team Canada athletes, you know, people who are in powerlifting, speed walking. Like, I don't really actually know anything about these things, but a little bit of research, and all you have to do is listen and ask proper follow-ups, and you can go a long way. So those experiences, I think, are making me better. Getting to work on Real Sports with Brian Gumbel, you know, those are 2-hour, like, intense, exhausting interviews that you're doing. You only see like a slice of them when it comes time to actually put the piece together. So all these things, I think, are making me better. And that's really why, like, the next phase of my life and career, which is going to start this summer, in my opinion, it can't just be about MMA, because that's the comfort zone. That's easy. I could do my show right now in my sleep, but showing people that I can interview, whether it's basketball players, soccer players, darts players, Olympians, whatever it is, I want to show that I can interview them all the same and be better than anyone doing that. So that's what I'm attempting to do.
Ariel, you were great. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That is Ariel Helwani. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com. And follow us at Awful Announcing.